From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you, and by support from the Central Indiana Community Foundation, the Indiana Arts Commission, a state agency, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today I'll chat with NPR's Puzzle Master and New York Times crossword editor Will Shortz, as well as with local businessman Mickey Maurer, who has created a few crossword puzzles himself.
I'll find out all about the Mahler Project at Butler University, and of course, we'll have our Arts Calendar Week haul.
What'll we do? All this and more right after the latest news from NPR.
Almost all NPR listeners will recognize the name Will Shortz. He has been the puzzle master for NPR's Weekend Edition Sunday since the program's start in 1987. He's also the crossword editor of the New York Times, and he is originally from Indiana. Will Shortz will be back home again on Wednesday, September 2nd, as part of the Mickey's Corner interviews with Mickey Maurer at the JCC. Travis DiNicola spoke with Will Shortz about his upcoming visit.
Will Shortz, thanks so much for talking with us on Art of the Matter today. It's great to finally get to chat with you.
Thanks a lot, Travis.
I'm a big fan. Listen to you, of course, every Sunday with the puzzle, and enjoy that very much, as I know many of our listeners do. A lot of people know you were raised in Indiana. Briefly, just tell me, though, about you've got a very special degree from Indiana University.
Right. Well, I was born and raised in Crawfordsville, and I went to IU. They have an innovative program there called the Individualized Major Program. If you're accepted, you can major in anything you want. And I devised a whole curriculum in enigmatology, the study of puzzles. And
wow.
I'm the only person in the world ever to get a degree in this.
What a fantastic thing that must have been. I've got to ask, though. I mean, when you told your parents you were going to get a degree in puzzles, was there any a pause there at all?
Oh, there's a big pause, yeah. My mom sort of went along with it a little bit because she was a writer and liked creative things. So she was actually the one who discovered the individualized major program. And so I think she went along with it all right. My dad was more the corporate type.
Mm-hmm.
He was a personnel director for Donnelly, R.R. Donnelly, the printing company in Crawfordsville. And he didn't think much of it. They both thought this would be a phase that I went through. They eventually, even my dad came around years later and thought, you know, this is going to work out all right.
Were you must have been, of course, a big fan of puzzles growing up as a kid even then.
Yes, I was always a puzzle head. I started making puzzles when I was 8 or 9.
Mm-hmm.
I used to play a game where I would take the names of towns and cities in Indiana and try to find as many words as I could from their letters. So I've always been good at anagrams and rearranging letters.
Do you remember some of your first crossword puzzles at all? Or?
Yeah. I tell you, first of all, most of my original early puzzles were types that I invented myself. I didn't get into crosswords till later on.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember once my mom had her bridge club over for the afternoon. She wanted to keep me quiet, so she took a piece of paper, ruled it into squares, showed me how words interlock, and I sat in my room all afternoon and created this crossword. And when the afternoon was over and the bridge club had left, my mom came in and numbered the grid for me,
mm-hmm.
and showed me how to write clues.
And
that
wow.
was the first crossword I ever made.
That's pretty neat. And how old were you then? Do you remember? Or?
I'm just guessing, 8 or 9.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Now, you've been the editor of the New York Times crossword puzzle for quite a while now. Actually.
Yeah, I started in 1993, so it's been 15 and a half years.
That's quite a both an honor and I would imagine a great responsibility. I mean, making sure you get it right.
Yeah, that's the most important thing. You know, of course, I'm trying to make the puzzles fun and fresh, and I want to twist your brain. But it doesn't matter how clever or good the crossword is if it has mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
So rule number one is make sure everything's correct.
Now, how can you give us a little bit of an insight into what your process is in creating a puzzle? I mean, do you start with one certain clue or word you want to make sure you build around, or do you start with the graph itself, or how does that work?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'll say for the Times, the puzzles are submitted by other people, mm-hmm. and it's my job to select my favorites and edit them. And one of we have several contributors, a number of contributors from Indiana, Mickey Maurer being a noted example. But if you're making a crossword, you start with your long answers first. Most crosswords nowadays have themes where the long answers tie together in some interesting way. So you start with those. You put those in the grid. You arrange your black squares around those, sort of breaking the diagram into chunks that you think you can fill with words. Then you actually fill it with words. And when you've polished the construction to your best of your ability, you write the clues.
Now, do different crossword puzzle creators have recognizable styles? You mentioned Mickey Maurer. You'll be on stage with him at the Jewish Community Center's Mickey's Corner, and he's certainly submitted many puzzles to the New York Times. I mean, when you see one of his, do you say, "Oh, of course, that's a Mickey Maurer puzzle"?
Uh-huh. What Mickey likes to do, I think, is well, first of all, he has a good sense of humor, so his puzzles can have a twist that is funny, but he likes to push the envelope. He likes to do something that no one else has ever done before. I'd say that's his specialty.
In terms of the words he chooses, or the types of clues that lead up to that word, or
I think in terms of the themes, mm-hmm. there is one puzzle that jumps to mind. It's not one I didn't accept it, I'm afraid, but it had words sticking out the sides of the grid.
Yeah.
Like if there was a five-letter answer on the right side of the grid, there was a six-letter word that went there, and the last letter sort of hung out. And the idea was that this puzzle would appear on Thanksgiving, and the extra letters on the side spell leftovers. Kind of cute. There were problems that made me not use the puzzle, but I admired it for its ingenuity.
Well, certainly. But generally, I mean, people who really enjoy crossword puzzles want there are certain expectations that that the puzzle will stay within the boundaries, in fact, of the grid.
Right.
Right.
Right. Well, I like to push those boundaries. there's in the old days, the answers were always. You could guarantee that a square would have a single letter in it. Nowadays, it's fairly common. Every month or two, I'll run a puzzle that will have a little picture or several letters squeezed into a single square. That's a very easy way of breaking the rules. I like to break the rules with the crosswords all the time. Always, of course, if there's a good reason for it.
Now, your experience, of course, goes beyond just crossword puzzles, all types of puzzles. One thing that I think is just had to have been a lot of fun to work on was the Batman movie. You actually helped create the riddles for the Riddler, is that correct?
That's right, for Batman Forever.
Uh-huh.
And they were actually filming the movie, and the director realized that they needed riddles for the Riddler, and no one in their group knew how to write a riddle. And they hear me on NPR with Leanne Hansen on Sunday morning,
uh-huh.
so they called and asked if I would prepare some riddles. The riddles could be anything I wanted, but each one had to have a number in it. That was crucial to the plot. It didn't mm-hmm. matter what the number was, but there had to be a number in the riddle. So I wrote four riddles, and they appeared in the movie.
Yeah. Now, were you a fan of the old Batman TV show? I mean, for me, that was the best part of that was always the old Riddler and his riddles that would lead to, Batman to the rescue.
Yeah, I was. I watched all the Batman shows mm-hmm. in the 60s.
Yeah, very fun. Now, what other types of puzzles do you continue to enjoy to both create and work on yourself? I mean, I know, is it the Ken that's a new one you have introduced?
Ken, yeah, that appears in the New York Times every day now mm-hmm. and is appearing, I don't know, 25 or 50 newspapers around the country now. It's a logic puzzle, a pure logic puzzle with numbers.
Like Sudoku?
It's like Sudoku, but arithmetic is actually involved in this, unlike Sudoku, which is pure logic, even mm-hmm. though it uses numbers. Yeah, this I'm a big fan of the puzzle, and it's the books that have been published that I've come out with have been successful. Really, almost I like almost any kind of puzzle. The things that bring me the most pleasure are British style crosswords, which I'm crazy about. I love to solve Friday and Saturday level New York Times crosswords. And I like to make up the puzzles of the sort that I use on NPR in the Sunday morning.
Yeah, that's got to be just such a great pleasure. I mean, to be on every week with Leanne Hansen and chatting with people every Sunday and coming up with those puzzles, it's certainly something that fans look forward to every week.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Yeah, I've been doing that since January 1987, so that's now 22 and a half years I've been doing those.
Now,
that's a lot of puzzles.
That's a lot of puzzles. When people call in, now, you know, that behind-the-scenes look we're trying to get here, is it recorded ahead of time? It's not live on Sunday mornings, right?
That's right. It's usually taped on Friday afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
What you hear on the radio on Sunday morning is real. We never retape.
Okay.
You know, I'll never say, okay, this puzzle's not working out, let's do something else, or let's go to somebody else. It's what you hear on the radio is what happened, but usually some of the awkward silences are removed.
Well, sure, but that's great to know that because it certainly sounds as though you can hear the tension in the voice. Of course, sometimes Leanne tries to help them a little bit too.
That's right. Well, Leanne is great. In the early days, the puzzles I gave the puzzles to Leanne every week, and she was in a no-win situation because if she got the puzzles real. If she got the answers really fast, then she was too smart, you know. And that's off-putting to listeners. And if she didn't get them, then she's just stupid. So there was no way she could win. And she came up with the idea to have me give the puzzles to listeners.
Mm-hmm.
She's at the side, you know. She will always wait for the listener to give the answer. And if the listener can't get it, and she knows, then she'll offer a hint.
And then she does such a great job with that. We just have a little bit of time left here, and I do appreciate your time very much. I'm curious if your love of puzzles transfers to other arts, and what I'm thinking of specifically is with like mystery novels or movies. Part of this comes to mind that we're having the BoucherCon conference, which is the
right.
The world's largest mystery writers and fans conference, coming to Indianapolis in October.
Right.
And are you a fan of mysteries yourself?
I like mysteries. I don't. I can't say I'm an expert on them, but I do like them. And Anthony Boucher was a huge crossword fan, and especially of the British crossword variety. And years ago, I was in a used bookstore in Los Angeles. This was after he died, and his library had gone to the store. And I bought a whole bunch of British crossword books filled in and that were signed by Anthony Boucher.
Well, who the BoucherCon is named after.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Hey, one other thing I'm just kind of curious about. I don't know if you've ever seen this type of puzzle before. Speaking of mysteries, years ago I bought a book, one of Martin Gardner's books, that features retrograde analysis of chess moves, and it's tied to Sherlock Holmes stories. And,
and
those puzzles, the way that they're done, it's not like a traditional chess puzzle where you're given the board and you're supposed to anticipate what the moves coming up will be. Instead, you're given the board and perhaps you're told, okay, is white on this square or that square? Is the white queen on, which square would it have to be on based on this position? Or what piece is missing, and so you're trying to sort of recreate the events led up to. Have you ever created any puzzles like that before or familiar with those?
Well, I'm certainly familiar with them, and I have done them. I can't say I'm expert at them. My mind is better on words than on logic. But I'm pretty good at those, and I like those, too. Yeah. My big pastime besides puzzles is table tennis, which I think ties in with puzzles because it's a thinking person's game. There's so much strategy involved, and geometry and physics, for that matter, as the ball bounces off the paddle. So every time I'm in Indianapolis, I play at the Indianapolis Table Tennis Club. And during my visit coming up, I plan to play at the Carmel Table Tennis Club, too.
Excellent. Well, I'm sure they're looking forward to seeing you there. Will Shorts, it's been a real pleasure chatting with you today, and thank you so much. And we're looking forward to seeing you as part of the Mickey's Corner coming up on September 2nd.
Great. Thanks a lot, Travis.
Travis DiNicola with NPR's Puzzle Master Will Shorts. Shorts will be interviewed by Mickey Maurer from Mickey's Corner at the JCC on Wednesday, September 2nd. For more information, visit the JCC website at jccindy.org. Again, jccindy.org. And stay tuned, because Travis will have an interview with Mickey Maurer coming up in just a minute. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Back to The Art of the Matter. In the first part of today's show, Travis DiNicola spoke with NPR's Puzzle Master, Will Shorts. Shorts will be interviewed by Mickey Maurer from Mickey's Corner at the JCC on Wednesday, September 2nd. Mr. Maurer, a well-known local businessman and attorney, is also a crossword puzzle creator himself. Travis DiNicola spoke with Mickey Maurer about how he creates a puzzle.
Mr. Maurer, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to see you in our studio.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
There are many things that I'm sure we could talk about, but today we're really limited to puzzles, and especially with Will Shorts coming in next week on the 2nd at the JCC for Mickey's Corner. You've been a big puzzle fan and creator yourself, correct? I mean, you've had a number in the New York Times.
Yes, I've had a couple dozen puzzles in the New York Times, including three Sunday puzzles, which are the big ones.
Mm-hmm.
And under Will Shorts and his predecessor Eugene Maleska, it's been fun.
When did you first create a crossword puzzle? Do you remember your first?
I remember when I first started working puzzles. I was in law school.
Mm-hmm.
And that senior year in law school gets kind of boring, and I looked around and I saw somebody having a lot more fun than I was, and he was working a puzzle. So
okay.
I brought a crossword puzzle to school from then on. And then I remember a few years later working a puzzle and saying, this was pretty lousy. I think I can do at least that good.
Mm-hmm.
And I made one.
How do you go about creating a puzzle? Do you have a theme in mind ahead of time? Do you fill out the blocks first?
Puzzles don't have to be thematic, but all of mine are.
Mm-hmm.
And in the New York Times, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Sunday
mm-hmm.
are thematic. Usually Friday and Saturday are not. All of mine, I said, are thematic, and I start with coming up with what I think will be a fun theme.
Mm-hmm.
And then you derive from that the theme clues, which you place in the grid. And then you put the black squares around, and then you fill in with other words.
How often does it, or how long does it take you to create a typical puzzle?
Well, a daily, which is 15 squares by 15,
mm-hmm.
takes about, for a New York Times level,
mm-hmm.
it takes about 4 to 6 hours. I don't just sit there for four
sure.
to 6 hours, but you work on it a little while and put it down. It's a
you
hobby.
Come back to it. And,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. I've heard a story from Will Shorts about your Thanksgiving puzzle with leftovers. Can you tell me a bit about that? Because if my understanding is correct, it actually didn't run.
No, I
but
don't.
It sounded like a great puzzle.
I think he liked it, but didn't want to mess up his grids, because I had letters that were spilling over on the outside of the boundary of the puzzle and the,
beyond the 15.
Beyond
15.
The 15. Mm-hmm. It was leftovers, Thanksgiving leftovers.
Mm-hmm.
But not everything I give him gets published.
Sure.
He's a tough taskmaster.
Can you tell me a bit about maybe one of your most recent puzzles or favorite clues you've included of late?
Well, I had one that I really liked, and he said it was so difficult that most people would get frustrated. And he didn't accept it, so I sent it to what's called Games Magazine.
Yeah.
And they, it's for a little bit more intense puzzle solver, mm-hmm. and they published it, and I showed it to him, and I said, see, Will, what you missed, here it is in black and white. But it was about a tightrope walker it was a jingle about a tightrope walker, and it went from left to right, and then another line went from right to left, and then the tightrope walker fell off the tightrope, so then it kind of dipped down.
Uh-huh.
And it was fun. Once you got it solved, you say, oh, that was pretty cool. But
yeah.
It was probably a little bit much for Will Shorts.
Now, he used to be the editor of Games Magazine.
Yes,
so,
that's where he came from.
And here you are sending it back to that. Do you still do puzzles yourself?
I work a puzzle. I'm addicted, so
yep.
I work one puzzle a day, the
you
New
do.
York Times.
Mm-hmm.
And when I don't get a chance to do my puzzle, I feel like I've lost something mm-hmm. during the day. Sometimes when I was Secretary of Commerce, I used to bring my newspaper to the legislature when mm-hmm. I had to meet with the legislature, and they were always late. And if there's any advice I gave to the people who came after me, I said, always bring a newspaper when you meet with the legislature. So I would bring my puzzle
mm-hmm.
and sit there and do my puzzle, knowing that invariably they're going to be late.
And doing a puzzle in pen and without a dictionary, I'm assuming.
Oh, yes. Yeah. But that's okay. If you practice, you can get there.
Mm-hmm.
And if I don't get it done during the day, then I do it before I go to bed.
Mm-hmm. What is it that you enjoy so much about puzzles? I mean, is it the words, the logic of it?
That's a great question. I don't know that I've asked myself that. I like the words, and I like the cleverness of
mm-hmm.
the New York Times puzzles, because the themes, except maybe Monday, but Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Sunday are usually very clever. Will has high standards.
Mm-hmm.
So when you work a Will Shorts edited puzzle, you not only have the satisfaction of filling in all the squares, but you get to say, oh, ha, ha, you know, that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
And also his clues, Will edits the clues pretty intensively. So when I submit a puzzle, I will expect that maybe a third to a half of my clues are edited by Will Shorts, changed.
Mm-hmm.
The
dramatically changed?
No, but
tightened up a bit.
Tinkered with the. Now, the letters that you put in the grid haven't been changed, but the
okay.
clues that give you the
I see.
Answers have been changed. And so, like, I had a clue that said bridge expert.
Okay.
Five letters. And most people would put in G-O-R-E-N. He's a very famous, Gorin was a famous bridge expert. Or I said bridge aficionado, is what I said.
Mm-hmm.
And my answer was troll, T-R-O-L-L, because a troll lives under the bridge.
Uh-huh.
And so I think Will said, maybe that's over the top.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that didn't survive. But he will try to accept your clues, but you'll see if you submit a puzzle that Will edits, at least a third have been changed.
Can you give us a preview of what you and Will will be doing on?
Oh, we're going to have so much fun.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Will doesn't know this, so I assume he doesn't have access, living in New York, to this program.
No, we won't tell him.
So, we won't give away the surprises.
Mm-hmm.
But we're going to have some audience participation.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to do a game that I made up. Occasionally, I'll make up a game for him to do on Sunday morning, so this is that kind of game.
Okay.
We'll work a puzzle. And there's a new craze called Ken.
Right. He was talking about that in his interview.
Well, Ken is in the New York Times now, right above the crossword puzzle. And we'll do a Ken, and audience will be with us every step of the way. Also, I'll show some clips from some movies, too.
Really? Movies about puzzles?
Movies that involve Will Shorts that you didn't know about.
okay.
An episode of The Simpsons.
Yeah, yeah.
Something from Batman. And there's something called Wordplay.
Okay.
So we'll have some movie clips that are, I think, fun and very, very enjoyable. So it'll be an active evening.
Excellent. And again, Wednesday night, the 2nd, at the Jewish Community Center as part of Mickey's Corner. This has been a great series of talks that you've had up at the JCC with a number of different guests.
Well, I'm glad you liked it and said it was a great series. I've had fun, and we've had some wonderful people.
Mm-hmm.
We had Bob Knight. That was a trip. We had Sylvia McNair, an extraordinary singer, and from the Metropolitan mm-hmm. Opera, and we've had Crystal DeHaan, we had our governor, We had Jeff Saturday, the center for the Colts, and Angelo Pizzo, who wrote Hoosiers. We've just had lots of fun.
Yeah, and it seems like you're having fun.
And each of these guests have a Hoosier connection.
Mm-hmm. Obviously.
It's nice to celebrate all the wonderful people that live in Indiana or that have an Indiana connection.
Travis DiNicola with businessman, attorney Mickey Maurer. Mr. Maurer will be interviewing NPR's Puzzle Master Will Shorts as part of Mickey's Corner at the JCC on Wednesday, September 2nd. For more information, visit the JCC website at jccindy.org. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
I noticed by the little dangly things on your shirt that you've been fringing a lot.
And I apparently got out alive. That's my clothes are shredded. No, that's not what fringe is about. Fringe isn't about fringy clothes. It's about fringy theater.
Depends on how close you get to the fire jugglers.
Oh, that's a good point.
Yeah, but, you know, it's the final weekend for the 5th annual Indie Fringe Festival, and there are so many fabulous things all the way from Fringe Next, which is the young people's show.
That's right.
To jugglers and magicians and singers,
opera,
songwriters, storytellers,
dance.
Opera, dance. What are we missing? Visual art, visual mm-hmm. fringe going on. Food available for purchase, beverages available for purchase.
Well, let's talk about fringe and everything else going on this weekend.
On?
The calendar we call.
What do we do?
hey, do you have a favorite fringe at this
you
point?
You know, I have a lot of favorites, but one thing I would encourage listeners, if they haven't had a chance to take in yet, is Kevin Kling. Yes, that Kevin Kling, Minneapolis-based NPR storyteller, singer, you know him as a multi-talented guy with messages full of great heart. And he has a couple more performances still to come this weekend. Do you have something you would recommend as Fringe is drawing to a close?
Yeah, I mean, there's always a lot of fun stuff and some great local artists. Taylor Martin, there's also a fun new group called New Vaudeville that's some of the guys from Blue Monkey Sideshow. One show that I just always love is Blunder Construction. It's sort of a great mime, slapstick type of vaudeville juggling. It's great for the whole family. There's shows actually going the rest of the weekend every night until 10:30.
Right.
They start during the day around 1:30 at the Phoenix Theater, at Comedy Sports, at Theater on the Square, at Earth House, all up and down Mass Avenue. You know, best thing to do is go to indiefringe.org if you haven't already and get a schedule and just hit a bunch of shows this weekend.
Absolutely, absolutely. All right. Well, here's something quite different from that. Maybe you've done all the fringing that you care to and you want to do something completely different. As you may know, there is a long tradition of Slovenians settling in Indianapolis, and the Indianapolis Slovenian Society is putting on events the next two Sundays. This Sunday, the 30th, Adoramus, a beautiful choir from Slovenia, will be singing at the Slovenian National Home, which is at 2717 West 10th Street. And the following Sunday, September 6th, you can start with a Mass at 9 a.m. Excuse me, you can start with a Mass at noon. Gates open at 9 a.m. And there is a picnic with food, beer, and music, and kids' activities as well. So lots of stuff going on. And check out the Slovenian Festival Indianapolis online for more details.
Very cool. I didn't know we had such a Slovenian population.
Yeah,
on the
west side. Yep.
Very neat. Very, very cool. Well, the last thing I got today is just want to give people a heads up that in about a month and a half or so, the world's largest mystery writers and mystery fan convention is coming to Indianapolis. It's called BoucherCon. And
it's called what?
BoucherCon. This is tricky. BoucherCon. BoucherCon. It's named after actually a gentleman named Boucher who sort of got it all started and was a big mystery fan and writer and all that stuff.
So it's like Gen Con, but it's like for mystery writers.
Exactly.
Okay.
And mystery writers from all over the world will actually be in town. Michael Conley, if you know his work, is going to be one of the special guests, as well as tons of other writers.
That is so
Sue
cool.
Sue Grafton. And right now, I think the latest thing I heard is about 1,200 writers and fans are all going to be in town. And there's a lot of really cool events that are a part of it. Anyways, if you are a mystery writer and you live in, or a mystery fan, and you live in Indianapolis, you don't want to miss this. You can actually go to BoucherCon2009.com to find out about all the different events and register if you want to participate in the book signings and seminars and panels and demonstrations.
You will so
and,
be there yourself,
oh, I
can tell.
I'm so excited. So, in fact, we'll do a couple interviews with some mystery authors in the coming month or so as we get ready for BoucherCon, Sharon.
That is so cool.
Very good. And we'll have more about mysteries and free things and
Slovenian
who knows what
folks
else.
And festival.
Next weekend on
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
Marks the 150th anniversary of the death of Austrian composer Gustav Mahler, and Butler University is using the occasion as inspiration for a year-long exploration not only of this musical genius, but also of all things Germanic in Indianapolis, from symphonic music to chamber music to poetry, dance, opera, film, visual art, and more. You can find the entire schedule at butler.edu/JCFA, while you listen to Sharon Gamble's conversation with Dr. Peter Alexander, Dean of Butler's Jordan College of Fine Arts. That's the JCFA.
How did Butler get intrigued by the idea of the Mahler Project?
Well, that's a bit of a tale. We have been experimenting with various interdisciplinary programs for the last half dozen years at Butler. We did a project called the Carmen Project with Butler Theater and the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra and Indianapolis Opera.
Yeah.
And we continued through a series of those sorts of things involving the campus with arts organizations, sometimes performances on campus, sometimes off campus, or both.
Mm-hmm.
And we found those to be very successful. In many ways, those interdisciplinary projects really are a continuation of a long tradition of Butler, which goes back into the 70s, maybe even the early 70s, the Romantic Festivals, which were these big festivals that got a lot of national attention at one point, at any rate. But those ceased to exist some years ago, and we picked up on that sort of interdisciplinary value, and I, as dean, was fortunate to have a leave in 2007, summer of 2007, and spent time in Germany, and have always been fascinated by turn of the century Vienna anyway, and that just exacerbated my interest. And what happened was that I started to think if we could put together, think about whether we could put together a program that would again tie us in with the arts organizations in the city and with various parts of Butler University. And see if there were just some natural and magical synergies that we could develop. And in fact, that's what I think has happened. We have tremendous buy-in for this project, and we really started talking about it about two summers ago. And it just has taken time to kind of gestate and ripen, and we're ready.
I'm really fascinated by that era too, and all of the really colorful characters who were in Vienna in particular, mm-hmm. around the turn of the last century. Do you remember your first exposure to Mahler?
Wow. Yes. Well, sort of. It's in my distant past. Probably in the 70s at some point, I spent a summer listening to Leonard Bernstein's recordings of the Mahler symphonies. He had
without too much of a play on words, he had really resurrected the Mahler symphonies, and they had somehow fallen into disuse, and he brought them back, and was an advocate during his whole life for the music of Mahler, and I suspect that in many ways he identified himself personally because of the fact that he was a composer, Bernstein, and a conductor, as well as Mahler. He Bernstein, very much identified with Mahler.
And he was Jewish, which wasn't always the politically right place to be.
That's exactly right. Yeah. That's exactly right. And anyway, the question, when did I first encounter Mahler? Well, I think probably at the point in which I really started to listen seriously to Bernstein conducting him. And he's been in and out of my consciousness as a listener, and I performed professionally for many years and as a musician, and so played some of the symphonies, which was always a thrill. Yeah.
As, for people who don't know your background?
As a clarinetist, yes.
Yeah. I can't imagine playing Mahler without your heart breaking. I know there's a professional reserve that musicians have to have, but especially in the late symphonies, you hear the heartbeat of this man with the frail heart, and it's just astonishing. Yeah.
Well, incredibly vivid music, music that somehow paints pictures of all kinds and almost speaks directly through words.
Now, we know that he was a titan. He wasn't necessarily perceived as that during his own lifetime, and that's part of what some of the presentations will get into, correct?
Yes, I think that Mahler and Klimt, Gustav Klimt, the great Viennese painter, who was a close friend of Mahler's, and others were like contemporary creators today, not understood fully, and had problems. I mean, Mahler to some extent was run off. He was the conductor of the court opera in Vienna, and was run off partially because he was Jewish, and partially because he was radical in what he was doing. And his music certainly created a stir. And if you read contemporary reviews of the premieres of his works, they're not necessarily favorable. So that's just part of it. It takes time to absorb these things, for a culture to absorb these monuments.
Yeah. What were the main objections to him at the time? That just he wasn't using the contemporarily accepted vocabulary?
One was that I think he used the contemporary vocabulary to some extent. I think it just the largeness of the works, the huge gestures were overwhelming.
There was a time that Mahler was invited to come to the United States, spent a little time over here, and
he spent two or three seasons in New York. He conducted the opera there, the Metropolitan Opera, and the New York Philharmonic, both. And he was an extremely demanding conductor, and so he ran into problems. The musicians resisted him, as you can well imagine, and so he ran into trouble both in Vienna because of that and in New York.
You're actually kicking off the year-long Mahler project with one of the Leadership Through the Arts forums, and before you talk about this specific one about the two Gustavs, what is the goal of the Leadership Through the Arts forums in general?
Well, Leadership Through the Arts Forum was a lecture series that we started in a college. This is, I think, seven and a half years or so. It's been in existence. We started with the idea of bringing major national figures here to speak to the campus and to the community. The lectures are always open to the public, and they're always free. And we've had a couple of Pulitzer Prize winners. One of the people we had was Philip Glass, for instance, and that was astonishing. And we've had several. Michael Kimmelman, who's the chief art critic for the New York Times, but was the music critic for the New York Times, was here. And Paul Goldberger from The New Yorker was here. We've had a number of major figures. And, in fact, Alexander Komeny, who was coming on September 10th to be our first Leadership Through the Arts Forum speaker for the year, is a major figure. She's written 8 books and innumerable chapters and catalog entries and other sorts of things. She's an art historian, but she's written on Beethoven and on Viennese culture extensively. And not only is she an authority and extremely highly regarded, but she's very entertaining. And she was in town about 4 years ago and delivered a lecture as part of a series that the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra did on Beethoven. So she did a lecture at that point, and I had read her works. I had never had an encounter with her until that point, and I found her very, very engaging and lots of fun. I'm really thrilled that she's going to be here. I've had an opportunity to read a couple of her books this summer, and I think she's going to be very inspiring and energizing at the same time.
And without this sounding too gossipy, the two Gustavs are, in fact, connected by a woman.
Well, they are, although, Gustav Mahler was born in 1860, Gustav Klimt 1862, so they were very contemporary. And Alma, who became Mahler's wife, and he was about 40, had a flirtation with Gustav Klimt. She was a teenage girl and at the time, and Gustav Klimt, of course, denied that in fact he was being flirtatious with her. But he was an outrageous womanizer, and he was probably guilty as charged.
I think Alma Mahler, Alma Schindler, she connected with some of the movers and shakers of the era and is an interesting person in that she had her own talent, but is also the intersection, the muse of, mm-hmm. of so many fascinating people in that era. This first lecture is the two Gustavs, Mahler, Klimt, and Vienna's Golden Decade, 1897 to 1907. And then we move very quickly, a couple of days later, and that's September 10th, by the way, at 7:30. It's free, open to the public. Anybody, mm-hmm. you don't have to know anything about Mahler or Klimt to attend, right?
That's exactly right.
And then a couple of days later, a few days later, actually, there is a, tell us about the Laban movement.
Well, Rudolf Laban was a modern choreographer. He developed a notation system that is used to notate dance. There's a way that dance can be notated so that it can be written down and preserved, and he developed that system. But he became interested in also using dance as a mechanism for developing communities. So he developed these large movement choirs where people that had no dance training would get together and practice movements together, and they could perform together and experience dance and health and all that went with it. If you think of Tai Chi and the mass Tai Chi gatherings that occur in China, I think in some ways this is like that. And if people want to participate, they can find out how to do that by going to the website that exists for the Mahler Project on the Butler University website.
And you don't have to be a dancer.
You do not have to be a dancer. That's not what it's about. It's if you can stand, walk, wave your arms, you can participate in this thing, and we're going to do it in the football stadium.
Because you might have 1,000 people or even more.
That's what we hope for. We hope that it will be a community event. Cynthia Pratt, one of our faculty members who does a tremendous amount of choreography for Dance Kaleidoscope, will be guiding this. She has been doing research all summer on Laban and this aspect of his work. She is certified in Laban notation, and so that's where this interest came from. And it should be
what pretty, a cool, cool happening.
Pretty, pretty interesting and very unusual. It doesn't happen often. Little is known about this aspect of Laban's work, and it's being unearthed at Butler. So we invite anybody who's interested to give it a try.
Will you be doing it?
I will. I'm teaching a class, and I'm going to have my students do it, and I'll be there.
That's worth the price of admission alone. And by the way, it's free.
Yes.
And I realize we won't have time to touch on all of the events, but I want to get into some of the early events of the Mahler year. Then you turn a dramatic corner to September 20th at 3 o'clock. School of Music Ensemble showcase concert that will actually be in Clues Hall. And what all works of Mahler will be involved in this?
Well, the Butler Symphony is going to do Totenfeier, which is translated Celebration of Death. And it was a big tone poem that Mahler wrote before the turn of the century. And it was to become the opening movement of the Second Symphony eventually. But it started off as a tone poem. It's about 30 minutes long, rarely done. And later in the festival, the Butler Symphony will be doing the Resurrection Symphony, the Second mm-hmm. Symphony, of which the tone poem, Totenfeier, is the opening part. And so the kids will learn it in its original form and then its transformed version as part of the Second Symphony. And in addition, the wind ensemble will be doing a piece, wind ensemble being basically an elite band, mm-hmm. Will be doing a piece, Mitternacht, with soprano, which is Mahler's only piece for band that he wrote on that concert, and then some other things as well. The event, which is included at 3 o'clock, is free, as are many of the Jordan College's events. We do about 350 arts events each year, and most of them are open to the public free of charge, so always a good place to go if you have time.
Yeah. A wonderful gift to the community, and not enough people know about
it. Nice of you to say that.
Yeah, yeah. We tap into our poet laureate, Indiana poet laureate, Norbert Krof, who, if you didn't figure out by his name, comes by his German, his interest in German, all things German naturally, and his youth in Jasper, Indiana. He will draw on that and read some of his, and talk about some of the German heritage of Indiana.
Which is very strong, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
40 to 50 million Americans, and I might have that figure wrong, but I think, if anything, I'm underestimating, come from German background. But particularly in this part of the country, in Indiana, Michigan, Wisconsin, Illinois, Minnesota, there are an awful lot of people of German background and mm-hmm. descent, and Norbert is one of them. One of the things that he's going to be doing, I think, is reading an original poem, if not on this concert or presentation, certainly on November 8th when he premieres a poem about the fall of the wall. And part of what we're celebrating with the Mahler Festival is the 20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. So it should be very interesting. And Norbert will be joined at his poetry reading by jazz pianist Monica Herzig and her colleagues. So it'll be an evening of really good poetry and jazz music.
Monica also actually is German, so mm-hmm. You know, and that you've just pointed out something important, that the Mahler Project not only is about Gustav Mahler, but it's a recognition of the fall of the Berlin Wall and how the world changed then, but also drawing in not just classical music, but jazz and poetry and movement and performance and theater and opera and everything but the kitchen sink, really, all tied together, because there are many, many intersections in this festival.
You know, you're exactly right. I'm one of the things that's happening in early October is that the Indianapolis Opera is doing Richard Strauss's opera, Ariadne auf Naxos. And that opera has become one of Strauss's favorite and most performed operas, and will star, if I can use that term, Angela Brown, among others. I believe a product of our city.
Indeed.
And Metropolitan Opera star. And it should be quite the event. And we're thrilled that all of these strands are going to be pulled together in different ways, because people who come to any or as many as they can of these events will, I think, come away with a deeper understanding of how all of these different art forms and the period that gave rise to them fit together.
And I should have said chamber music and film and visual art. And what am I leaving out? I feel as though I'm leaving out
dance,
something important. Dance,
perhaps.
Yeah.
Not only with the Laban movement choir piece, but the Butler Ballet in winter will be doing an Anthony Tudor piece, which we worked very hard to get access to. It's not so easy sometimes. And that worked out very well for us. And so they will be doing, Butler Ballet will be doing Dark Elegies, which was Tudor's response in ballet to the rise of Adolf Hitler. So it'll be far-reaching, I think, some of these events.
In addition to not only bringing the community into Butler and into partnerships that Butler is a part of, obviously big projects like this help your students and your faculty and your staff stretch and grow. But I have a sense that Butler is maybe not unique but unusual in tackling projects of this scope. Is that true?
I would like to think that's the case, certainly. the thing that's been fun about this is, for me, being able to convene people and convene organizations and think more globally and get off of the campus, out of the Butler bubble, as we like to say, and more into the community and see if there were ways that we could work together. You know, one of the things that we're certainly experiencing in Indianapolis is a reduction in arts funding for all kinds of reasons that we don't need to go into. And I think one of the ways that we can counteract that is to find ways to work together and to draw attention to ourselves, we in the arts community, by understanding that the arts not only are about entertainment and about single events, but they're about education. Every time one goes to an arts event, one learns something. And if one can link arts events in creative ways together, learning is heightened and perhaps relevance is heightened. And that's what this festival is about to some extent. It's about us, we, I should probably say, at Butler, trying to see if we could program in ways that heighten comprehension, appreciation, and education.
Sharon Gamble with Dr. Peter Alexander, Dean of Butler's Jordan College of Fine Arts. The Mahler Project begins with a free talk at Butler's Idson Duckwall Recital Hall by Alessandra Camini at 7:30 on Thursday, September 10th. The talk is called The Two Gustavs, Mahler, Klimt, and Vienna's Golden Decade, 1897 to 1907. Visit butler.edu/JCFA, that's for Jordan College of Fine Arts, for the full schedule of events and learn how to participate in the Laban happening. Again, butler.edu/JCFA. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Al Studios at alstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4. I get to preview Opera Palooza and take a look at the upcoming Chinese Fest. And, of course, we'll have our Arts Calendar Week all.
What do we do? So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 for The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter is made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and by grants from the Arts Council of Indianapolis and from the City of Indianapolis, and by support from the Central Indiana Community Foundation, the Indiana Arts Commission, a state agency, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.